This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We are very excited to welcome David Grand, Politics and Prose, to discuss his new book, Killers of the Flower Moon. David is a journalist who has written for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The Hill, The Atlantic, New York Times Magazine, and many others. He is also the author of The Lost City of Z, which was recently turned into a movie. You can see it in theaters now. And The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. In his latest book, Killers of the Flower Moon, he investigates a relatively unknown aspect of American history, the suspicious deaths of members of the Osage Indian Nation of Oklahoma in the 1920s. At the time, the Osage were some of the wealthiest people in the world, thanks to the oil found on their land. The fledgling Federal Bureau of Investigation eventually took over the case of the Osage murders, discovering extensive prejudice, corruption, and deliberate obstructions of justice. Their work, which David continues with his own research for this book, eventually reveals one of the most horrific and tragic conspiracies in the history of our country. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming David Grand, Politics and Prose.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back in Washington, D.C. I used to live here, in another moon ago. And it's great to be here to be able to talk about my new book, Killers of the Flower Moon. The Osage murders and the birth of the FBI. This project began several years ago when I made a visit out to the Osage Nation in Northeast Oklahoma. And when I was there, I stopped at the Osage Nation Museum. And they had this enormous panoramic photograph on the wall. This is just a fragment of it. It spanned all the way from here all the way to that wall. And when I was looking at it, it looked like a very innocent pageant of members of the Osage Nation with white settlers. It was taken in 1924. But I noticed that there was a panel missing, and you can actually see the full panoramic photograph on the title page of the book. This panel about over here was cut out. And I asked the museum director why it was missing. And she said it had contained a figure so frightening that she decided to remove it. And she then pointed at the missing panel, and she said the devil was standing right there. And that led me to begin to try to understand who that figure was, who that devil was, and the anguishing history he embodied. And it led me to what I would come to realize was one of the most mysterious and sinister crimes in American history, one that I believe tells a much larger story about this country. Now, the murders of the Osage took place during the 1920s. And to understand them, even earlier than that, but the beginning of the 20th century, and to understand them, you need to understand that back then the Osage had become the wealthiest people per capita in the world. Because under their land in Oklahoma, there had been oil. And to obtain that oil, prospectors had to pay the Osage for leases and royalties. And there was about 2,000 or so members of the nation that were registered who would receive a quarterly check every 4 months per year. And initially, in the early 1900s, it was just for, $100 or so, and then it grew to $1,000. And over time, it accumulated into the millions. Just to give you a sense, in 1923 alone, the Osage collectively, those 2,000 or so, accumulated what would be worth today the equivalent of more than $400 million. Now, the public became transfixed by the tribe's prosperity. A New York newspaper wrote, "Lo and behold, the Indian, instead of starving to death, enjoys a steady income that turns bankers green with envy." And they would head out to Osage Nation and tantalize the readers with these images, which belied longstanding stereotypes that could be traced back all the way to the first contact with whites. And they would speak of the quote-unquote, and again, these stories were filled with prejudice, so I put things in quotes, the red millionaires and the plutocratic Osage, and they would portray them with their terracotta mansions and their fur coats. They would describe how they had white servants, which caused great unease among many whites. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 of them.
Jesus God.
You could see some pictures. And this photo, if it works, I particularly like just because it shows that period, the dislocation between a more traditional Osage with her daughters who were dressed as flappers. The tangled history, oh, actually, before I do that, let me see if this will work, too. But in any case, I actually found some old silent footage from the 1920s. I was actually shot by an Osage with his camera, and you could see the cars in these booming towns. The tangled history of how the Osage had gotten hold of this oil-rich land went back to the 17th century, when the Osage had laid claim to much of the central part of the country, a territory that stretched from what is now Missouri and Kansas all the way to the edge of the Rockies. President Thomas Jefferson called the Osage in 1803 the Great Nation, and the following year he met with a delegation of Osage chiefs at the White House, and he assured them that they shall, quote, know our nation only as friends and benefactors. But over the next two decades, the Osage were forced to cede more than 100 million acres of their ancestral land, and in the 1860s, after being confined to a reservation in southeastern Kansas, they were again under siege by white settlers. And among them was the family of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who later wrote Little House on the Prairie based loosely on her experiences. And in a scene in the novel, Laura asks her mom, quote, why don't you like Indians? I just don't like them, and don't lick your fingers, Laura. This is Indian country, isn't it? Laura said, what do we come to this country for if you don't like them? One evening, Laura's father explains to her that the government will soon make the Osage move away. Quote, that's why we are here, Laura. White people are going to settle all this country, and we get the best land because we get here first and take our pick. Many squatters began, in fact, to take the land by force, massacring many Osage. A U.S. government official said at the time, quote, the question will suggest itself, which of these people are the savages? In the 1870s, the Osage agreed to sell their Kansas lands and search for a new homeland. They considered purchasing 1.5 million acres in what was then Indian territory and what is today Oklahoma. And although this area was vast, most whites regarded the land as broken, rocky, sterile, and utterly unfit for cultivation, as one U.S. government official put it, which is why this Osage chief stood up at the time at a council meeting and said, my people will be happy in this land. The white man cannot farm there, and he will finally leave us alone, so we should move there. And so the Osage bought this seemingly forsaken territory for 70 cents per acre and resettled there. The series of forced migrations, here you can see an early Osage camp on the new reservation, had taken a tremendous toll on the Osage Nation. Its population had dwindled to just a few thousand by then, a third of what it had been just 70 years earlier, from disease and hunger and massacres. Then in 1906, just before Oklahoma became a state, the government forced upon the Osage the culmination of its brutal assimilation campaign, allotment. And under this policy, the Osage reservation would be divvied up into parcels, with each tribal member receiving one allotment, while the rest of the territory would be opened up to settlers. The Osage could see where other tribes and places had been allotted in Oklahoma. This is one of the Oklahoma land runs where settlers are rushing in to take land. The allotment system was designed to end the old communal way of life and to turn American Indians into private property owners, which not incidentally would make it much easier to procure their land. During negotiations with Congress over the terms of allotment, the Osage had more leverage than many other tribes because they had a deed to their own land, and there was a great race to make Oklahoma a state. And the Osage at that time were led by one of their best, greatest chiefs, a man who spoke seven languages, including Latin. And they negotiated very hard with the U.S. government, and they inserted at the time what seemed like a very curious provision into their treaty, which essentially said that they shall maintain all the subsurface mineral rights to their land. Now, the Osage knew that there was some oil deposits under the reservation, but few imagine that the tribe was sitting on a fortune. And the Osage shrewdly managed to hold on to this last realm of their land, a realm that they could not even see. Each Osage on the tribal roll received a headright, which was essentially a share in the Osage Mineral Trust. And after allotment, much of Osage surface territory disappeared into the hands of whites. But no one could buy or sell headrights. These could only be inherited. And so the Osage maintained control of what had become the first underground reservation. Now, before long, the oil boom had begun. There was such demand for oil. At first, it was just trickles. By 1910, there was more deposits. By 1919, they were discovering some of the largest deposits then in the United States. All the oil barons who you've heard of, many of them first made their fortunes in the Osage. J.P. Getty went there with his family as a little boy. They first struck oil in Osage territory. E.W. Marlin made a fortune there and, of course, then blew it. Harry Sinclair, the Phillips brothers. They would gather for auctions and for leases for the land. And a lease could sell for 160-acre tract for as much as $2 million. And in good weather, the auctions were held. Here you can see the Phillips brothers and their company arriving on what was on a train for the auctions. These trains were known as the Millionaire Specials because of these private railroad cars which would bring the oil barons into the county. The auctions were held in good weather underneath this large tree, this elm tree, which became known as the Million Dollar Elm because of the price of leases. As the Osage prosperity increased, the U.S. Congress, it provoked kind of what now just seems outrageous alarm among many white Americans. There was a great deal of prejudice. There was this sense of scapegoating of the Osage, the sense that something had to be done. And the U.S. Congress literally would hold committee hearings, a bunch of men sitting in mahogany panel rooms, where they would debate the Osage wealth and what are we going to do about it, as if the nation's security were at stake. They had already passed legislation requiring that many Osage have white guardians. This system was deeply racist. It was literally based on the quantum of Osage blood. So if you were a full-blooded Osage, you were deemed, quote-unquote, incompetent, and you were given a white guardian. Not only was the system racist, it was it created essentially a criminal enterprise in which many guardians swindled and embezzled millions of dollars from the Osage. At a congressional hearing around then, this Osage chief testified that the whites had bunched us down in the roughest part of the country, thinking we will drive these Indians down to where there is a big pile of rocks and put them there in that corner. Now that the pile of rocks had turned out to be worth millions of dollars, he said, everybody wants to get in here and get some of that money. Then the Osage began to die under mysterious circumstances. One Osage family was profoundly infected. This family of this woman, Molly Burkhart. Molly, who was born in 1886, grew up in a lodge, which is like a wigwam, on the reservation, practicing Osage traditions, speaking only Osage. Within a few decades, she was residing in a mansion with white servants. She had married a white settler from Texas named Ernest Burkhart. And in many ways, she straddled not only two centuries, but two civilizations. They lived with their two children that they raised, and just for a little bit of context, their mother lived in their house with them. She was one of the last of the Osage elders at the time. He still practiced all the traditions. And Molly had a couple sisters who also lived nearby, one Anna Brown and one Rita Smith. And then one day in 1921, Molly's sister Anna Brown disappeared. That's a picture of Ernest and Molly and her husband. That's a picture of Molly's sister, Anna Brown, who disappeared in May of 1921. Molly looked everywhere for her. She had the family help look for her. A week later, Anna Brown was found in a ravine. This ravine here, which was taken by an early investigator at the time. She had been shot in the back of the head. Soon after, Molly's mother grew inexplicably sick. Each day, she seemed to drift further away, to become more insubstantial. Finally, less than 2 months after Anna's murder, her mother stopped breathing. Evidence would later suggest that she had been poisoned. Here you can see a picture of Anna Brown and her mother, and Molly's on the right, before Molly lost both her mother and her sister under these brutal deaths. Now, not long after that, Molly had another sister, Rita Smith. And Rita was so frightened by these deaths. She had lived in the countryside with her white husband and a white maid. They decided to move closer to town, near where Molly lived, so they would be safer. They had watchdogs, but one day the watchdogs died. They had been poisoned. Then one day at about 3 in the morning, Molly heard a loud explosion. This is the house that they had moved into town. Then one night at 3 in the morning, Molly heard a loud explosion. She went to the window and she looked out where her sister's house had been, and all she could see was this great orange ball rising into the sky. It looked as if the sun had burst violently into the night. It turned out that somebody had planted a bomb under her sister's house, killing her sister, Molly's sister Rita, Rita's husband, and the maid. Everybody died who was in the house. Other Osage families were also being systematically targeted, not just Molly's family. A champion Osage steer roper one night received a call from his house. He went out. Soon after he returned home, he dropped dead, frothing at the mouth. Evidence would later suggest that he had been given strychnine. Strychnine is a terrible poison. It often shows up in Agatha Christie mysteries because it's so brutal. It literally makes the whole body convulse as if with electricity. And while you're slowly suffocating, you are still conscious until you mercifully die. And several of those who tried to catch the killers were themselves killed. One attorney who gathered evidence was thrown off a speeding train. All the evidence that he had stashed away, when they went to retrieve it from the safe where he had told people he was keeping it, it had already been cleaned out by the time the authorities got to it. Somebody had gotten to the evidence first. Another man went all the way to Washington, D.C. to hopefully plead with authorities to get help. He checked into a boarding house in Washington, D.C. He received a telegram from Oklahoma that said, "Be careful." He carried with him just a Bible and a pistol. That night, he left the boarding house. He was abducted. A burlap sack at one point was wrapped over his head. His body was found the next day in a culvert in Maryland. He had been beaten to death and stabbed more than 20 times. The Washington Post at the time reported what had become increasingly clear and already known to the Osage, that there was a conspiracy to kill rich Indians, said the headline. In 1923, more than 24 people had been murdered in what had become known as the Osage Reign of Terror. One reporter wrote at the time that members of the tribe had been, quote, shot in lonely pastures, bored by steel as they sat in their automobiles, poisoned to die slowly, and dynamited as they slept in their homes. The reporter went on, "Where would it end? No one knows." The world's richest people were becoming the world's most murdered. Despite the danger to their lives, Molly Burkhard and other Osage crusaded for justice, but local white authorities frequently ignored the crimes because of prejudice, because the victims were Native Americans. At the time, the legal system, and I was shocked to discover this during my research, it was an incredibly lawless country, and the legal institutions were often rotten to the core. Many lawmen, especially in the frontier, had very little training. One of the reasons poisoning was so common at the time was because nobody would do toxicologies. Even though scientists knew how to do toxicologies, nobody would administer them. So you could poison somebody and it would be an easy way to get away with murder because the lawmen would just, you know, they wouldn't test the body. And it was also, there was a widespread corruption. I mean, it was very easy to buy the law. Molly hired private detectives at the time. Private detectives often filled the void back then of because of this lack of good law enforcement in many parts of the country. The problem with privatizing justice, though, was that often the private detectives would bow to the highest bidder. And also, they often had criminal backgrounds. And the boundary between a good man and a bad man was extremely porous. And many of the investigators working on the Osage case seemed to be concealing evidence rather than revealing it. Finally, in 1923, the Osage Tribal Council issued a resolution pleading for federal authorities to step in, and the case was taken up by a then little-known branch of the Justice Department that was later renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Osage murders would become one of the FBI's first major homicide cases. And one day in the summer of 1925, this man, a field agent in Houston named Tom White, got a summons, urgent summons, to go to headquarters in Washington, D.C. The new boss man, J. Edgar Hoover, is asked to speak to him right away in person. Now, like Molly, and he's the story focuses on Molly and a lot on Tom. Tom was also in many ways a transitional figure. And this story really is in many ways about the formation of a modern country. Tom White also straddled two centuries. He was born in a log cabin in Texas with almost no money. He came from a family of lawmen. He began his career as a lawman when justice was often meted out by the barrel of a gun. And by the 19th, there you can see, he became a Texas Ranger before he joined the Bureau. And by the time of the Osage case, he has to wear a suit. He's trying to learn new modern techniques like fingerprinting. He has to file paperwork, which he can't stand to do. Now, when he joined the Bureau in 1916, the Bureau was a pretty much a ragtag operation. Had only been in business for about a decade. Had only 100 or so agents. They weren't authorized to carry guns. They didn't have arrest power, so they'd have to get a local lawman to actually carry out the arrest. And they also had very little jurisdiction over crimes, and that wouldn't come till the 30s, where they had broader national jurisdiction. But one of the jurisdictions they had was over American Indian reservations, which is why the Osage case fell to the Bureau and why it became one of their first major homicide cases. So when White entered headquarters, and here you can see this picture was taken just a few months before White showed up at headquarters, so that's exactly, believe it or not, as J. Edgar Hoover looked back then. He didn't have the jowls. He didn't look like a bulldog. He was only 29 years old. He was the new acting director. By the time White showed up, he was named director. And so he summons White. At that point, he had been purging many of the old frontier lawmen from the Bureau, replacing them with a new breed of agent, these college boys who type faster than they shot. Now, the problem is most of these guys didn't have any criminal experience. They didn't actually know how to investigate a case. And so Hoover had kept on just a handful of the old frontier lawmen, including White, who were known as the Cowboys. And so when White shows up, he's not exactly sure what's going on. And Hoover begins to tell him about the Osage case. Now, the Bureau had been working on the case for 2 years, but the results had been disastrous. Not only had agents not made a single arrest, they had released an outlaw from prison, a man named Blackie, hoping to use him as an informant. Instead, he slipped away, robbed a bank, and murdered a police officer. Blackie would later meet his own unfortunate end when he tried to escape from prison and was gunned down. So Hoover is in a panic because he's new in his job. He fears a scandal, and believe it or not, Hoover was still insecure about his power. He had dreams of building an empire, but this was in its incipient stages. And White realizes Hoover wants him to take over the case because he has experience, essentially to help protect Hoover's career or job. So White then puts together an undercover team. He realizes, given the danger in the region, that only undercover operatives would work. Most of the people working undercover were from the Cowboys, this group of old lawmen. I got this picture from one of the granddaughters of this lawman who went undercover. Interestingly enough, one of the operatives who went in undercover was an American Indian. And the Bureau didn't keep statistics back then, but I think it's fair to say that he was probably the only American Indian in Hoover's Bureau. They go in undercover. Some pose as cattlemen. One poses as an insurance salesman selling actual policies. During that time, and as I describe in the book, they're learning to adapt new methods because this case kind of tracks with the evolution of law enforcement and scientific detection. One of the things they use is handwriting analysis, which becomes a key part of this case. Now, the investigation had many twists and turns, and at times it was more akin to espionage than a criminal investigation. There were moles, there were double agents, there was possibly a triple agent. Reports were being leaked. The agents were being followed. It was impossible to know who was your friend and who was out to betray you. And I won't give away the end because I think it is much more powerful to read in the context of the book. But White and his men ultimately followed the money to see who was benefiting from the killings. and this led them to one of the masterminds of the plot. He was a white settler. What's more, he was someone very close to Molly and the Osage, and many Osage. And that's one of the things that made these crimes so incredibly sinister. These were deeply intimate crimes in which it involved people pretending to love you while plotting to kill you. And these plots were carried out over a span often of years. They were intricate, and they involved a level of deception in all my career of covering crimes I've never, ever encountered. William Shakespeare and Julius Caesar has these words, which I think is true of this case. Where will thou find a cavern dark enough to mask thy monstrous visage? Seek none conspiracy. Hide it in smiles and affability. After I had visited the Osage Nation Museum and saw the panoramic photo, the museum director had gone down into the basement and she retrieved an image of the missing panel and showed it to me. And it contained the picture of that mastermind who the FBI had arrested. He was the so-called devil that she had been referring to. And I think it's important to point out that the Osage, and we're so fortunate, we actually have a whole contingent of Osage here, which I'm really happy about, and maybe they'll share any thoughts at the end during the questioning. But the Osage and the museum director had removed that photo not to forget, as so many Americans had, but because they can't forget. Now, just a quick word about the structure of the book. I structured it in an unusual way. It's structured in three chronicles, and each one is told largely from the point of view of a different individual. The first is told largely from the point of view of Molly Burkhart. And just one, this is a picture closer to the end of her life. And just one really striking detail I found in an archive about Molly. In 1934, just 2 years before she died of natural causes, I found a document saying where she had appealed her incompetency and she was deemed competent. So only 2 years before her life, she died in 1934. She was born in the 1880s. She was finally granted the rights of a full-fledged citizen to have access to her money and her resources. The next chronicle is told largely from the point of view of Tom White. Here's a later picture of him with Hoover, and you can already see the transformation of the cowboy. And then the third chronicle is narrated in the present by me. And I try to show what has happened to the Osage today. Here's an old picture when I was out there that I saw of a bar that had closed up. This was near where, not far from where Anna was initially kidnapped before she disappeared. And I try to show what has happened to their money, to the oil. And I was able to interview a lot of the descendants of the murderers and the victims. And what's so remarkable is they often now live side by side in the same neighborhoods. One of the most powerful, moving moments I have was a meeting with Margie Burkhart. And this is the granddaughter of Molly. And she was able to share with me stories about her life, about her family, about Molly. She stressed to me the anguish of growing up and not having aunts and cousins. And one of the other things is she gave me a picture, and because these were intimate crimes, you could have a picture where the victims and the perpetrators once appeared. And she gave me one picture where the victim was standing on one side and she had ripped out, Molly had ripped out the picture of the perpetrator. So you could just see the head of the victim and the perpetrator had been torn out of the photo. Gives you just a sense of what these crimes were like and how they affected families for generations. And one of the reasons I structured the book this way, telling the story from three distinct vantage points, was to hopefully illuminate how hard it is to discern history as it is unfolding. Only with time does more of the portrait emerge. And in the third chronicle, I document, based on a wealth of new information, that though the FBI caught several of the killers, there was a deeper and darker conspiracy that the Bureau never exposed. Be happy to answer any questions and anyone have. This is a graveyard in Gray Horse that Margie took me to, where many of her family members are buried, including Molly and Anna and Rita. Yeah, any questions? Yeah.
If one of the undercover agents sold insurance, Do those turn out to be legitimate policies? Were they honored by the companies?
Apparently they were. I mean, I couldn't find more evidence other than that I found records saying they were actual legitimate policies. And what was interesting, the guy selling them had once been an insurance salesman, so it was not such a hard cover to maintain. Yes?
A specific question and a more general one. Do the Phillips brothers or their attorney, whose last name I think was Kane, figure at all in your story? That's my specific question. My general question is, when you were researching this book, are there still people trying to cover up what happened?
Well, that's a good question. So to the first question, the Phillips factor into the story in the sense that they're part of the oil boom, and I describe them at the auctions. One of the Phillips brothers told the story about how at an auction he once his brother accidentally nodded and they lost a couple million by so he's part of that scene. I would say one of the striking things, and it's when you study history, you know, you're chasing ghosts often, and you're limited by your materials. But one of the things I found very striking is I could find no record of any of the oil barons ever commenting upon the murders while they were transpiring. People were getting too rich. And I found that kind of shocking, that there wasn't a single report that they were still showing up into Osage County to participate in the audit. Now, it's possible maybe they said something and we don't have a record of it. And I say that because, again, it's history. But that was something that shocked me. As to your question about covering up, what's interesting is I spoke to an Osage elder, a woman named Mary Jo Webb. She's probably in her 80s now. She described for me how a lot of the descendants live side by side, the descendants of the murderers and the descendants of the victims. She said often the descendants of the murderers, and I interviewed several of them, don't know fully what their relatives did. She, I thought with a great deal of Christian forgiveness, she's Christian, said, we don't hold them responsible. We don't, for the blood. She also described, though, how she had gathered evidence and once put it in the library and so the people would have it, and that disappeared. So I think there are still people who are uncomfortable with that history and having it fully known. I will say that I spoke to one descendant of a murderer who sent me an email, and he said, I just want you to know I'm very, in this case, he's a young man, I'm so ashamed. He's actually a descendant of Molly, that chain of perpetrators and victims in the same family, but his ancestors were among the perpetrators. And he said, I'm deeply ashamed of what they did. And if you see the Osage, please tell them that for me. And I thought that was very interesting that he said that. Yeah.
So I've read the book, and yeah. I highly recommend it to everyone who's here. It's brilliant. It's illuminating. And it's unbelievable that I didn't have any sense of this history. So said, my question is, how unique do you think this situation was? There must be other tribes who also had wealth beneath the ground, the underground reservations.
Yeah.
Is it conceivable that something like this, so fraught with conflict of interest, intermarriage, looking for, as much money as you could. Is this a unique situation? That's my question. And I know you probably don't know the answer, but your speculation.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, there certainly were other cases. Even in Oklahoma, there's a famous case of a Creek. I'm forgetting his name now. The thing that made the Osage unique was that they were an underground reservation which collectively maintained control of their land, the size of Delaware, everything underneath. There were other stories of individual Native Americans, including in Oklahoma, this case of a Creek, who, if they owned land, oil was found underneath and ended up getting wealthy. But it wasn't a collectively shared. So that's what made it distinct. But in that famous case, there were various levels of all the same, not murder, but all the same shenanigans to steal the wealth. I think the Osage case has its own particular history, its own particulars, but I was struck again, I'm not an expert in all this stuff. I know a lot about this case, but I spoke to an Osage who had walked all the way from Oklahoma recently to Standing Rock, to Sui, during the demonstration to participate in them. A guy named Chris Trilley was a war vet, received a Purple Heart when he was wounded, had his knee blasted in Afghanistan. And he told me along the way he was thinking about the killings. And other Osage also went to Sui. But when I spoke to a former Osage chief, he told me you know, one of the reasons it's galvanized so many people is because it's still the same fundamental issue, which is about, even though the situations are different, it's essentially about the rights of Native Americans to control their resources and land. And that's what connects them. And I think when you see the galvanizing of so many American Indian nations, you realize that they all have their own version of these stories, which is what galvanizes them. Anybody else? Yeah.
Yes. I'd be very interested to know how you first came to be so very interested in this and what drove you. We also know about government, the U.S. government, taking over, trying to take over the Black Hills and the gold found in the Black Hills. So this is not unique, of course, as you know. But your research is so daunting. I'd really like to know more about how you started. Please.
Yeah, I mean, it began, I heard about the story from a historian, and it really did begin with that trip out when I began the talk out to Osage Nation, because at that point I didn't really have a sense of the story. And when I came across this, the museum director would later become a very good friend of mine, but that's really what began it. And then there was still a question of how could I tell this story, because the one thing I did not want the book to be was just a cataloging of the dead. And the other thing I didn't want it to be is just the FBI perspective. And when you read the accounts that I would read about it, you know, Molly Burkhart is literally a sentence in every newspaper story. And here is a person at the center of this conspiracy, and nobody grants her more than a sentence. She has almost no agency. And now I was limited by the historical records, but I was determined to do as best I could to excavate that. And I spent a year where I just did Freedom of Information Acts to every single government institution, including prisons. I wrote to every sheriff's office. I wrote to every courthouse. And I literally spent a year before I committed to the project just to see what underlying materials were there. After a year, I went and looked at those materials. Sometimes they say, oh, we're sorry, we lost that in a flood. But often you get an envelope, and sometimes you would get boxes of materials, sometimes thousands and thousands of pages. And at that point, I became more committed to the project. It would be only probably 1/100th of what I would need to do the book, and the book took me close to 5 years of archival research. And a lot of that archival research could be unbelievably tedious, because you're just in a mass. I would spend a lot of time in a place called Fort Worth at a branch of the National Archives, and it looks like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like just an enormous like warehouse, and you literally just imagine the ark going up, and you have like these two poles you can get, and then they drive the little thing and they bring your box out. And things are, you know, this, you're looking 100 years ago, things are cataloged well, it'll just be like Guardian papers or, you know, and you don't know what you'll find. And then, like, you'll be going, I literally spent weeks out there, I did 2 trips, weeks, and your eyes are watering. And then you open a folder and you see something like the secret grand jury testimony to some of the trials that had, to my knowledge, never been made public. And then one time I pulled Guardian papers. And in the Guardian papers, I was just, at that point, I was just actually trying to check the name of a Guardian to see what Osage, he was in charge of the finances. And I pulled this little book, and I want to be a little careful to describe because I can't remember exactly the years it was, but it was like a little, it had a fabric cover. It was just like, it looked almost like a diary. It was like a ledger. It was like a ledger. And it had the names of the guardians, and then all it had underneath them was the names of the Osage whose finances they had overseen. And when I started looking down at the check the name, I started to notice that if an Osage had died, they had written the word dead next to the name. I said, okay. And so I go down, and I started to notice that, like, one guardian had 5 Osage, and written next to each one, it said dead, 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 dead. And then you go down a little bit, and again, you don't know if, well, let me, you go down a little bit more, and then you would, sometimes you would see another, like a 50% death rate under a guardian, or a 100% death rate. Now, you know this defies any natural death rate. And you begin to realize you're looking at hints of a systematic murder campaign contained in a very bureaucratic forensic document. And you don't know, again, you have to be careful. You don't know, some of those deaths could have been natural. But again, it defies any logic. I then began to try to target those cases. And on many of them, you can find trails of evidence, and they start to suggest complaints at the time of a poisoning, complaints at the time of a suspicious death. And so again, you're starting to realize the depth and breadth of this conspiracy and how sinister it was. But to me, that document was so damn striking because I just kept trying to imagine the bureaucrat who just kept writing in the document, dead, dead. And it gets to the question of complicity again. Yeah.
I think he was.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. There's lots of archives that are like that. It's what makes them great fun to visit. One of the books that I really enjoyed as a kid was Don Whitehead's The FBI Story, an account of the Bureau, and this case is treated in there, and was kind of the start of their professionalization in science. And it certainly emphasized to me that you didn't have to carry a weapon to be a law enforcement officer. There were things anybody could do if they developed some expertise, and Hoover really did bring the FBI into the provenance as being a great investigative agency until, of course, Contrapel and things like that.
You could see the two sides of Hoover in this book. It's really interesting because it's his formative period. You could see his organizing genius, and he had it. I mean, he was the greatest bureaucrat, and he had an organize. And he, you know, the way he remade the Bureau with efficiency and reports and everything had to be professionalized. There's just no question.
They cover everything.
Yeah. And the other question was, and then on the other side, you can see his politicization at times of the Bureau.
Any other FBI situations which could stand some going over, though?
What's that?
Any other FBI?
I'm sure there are. If any suggestions, I'm looking for a new book, so feel free. I promise a nice dinner. How much more time do we have? Okay, perfect. 10 more minutes.
Two questions. Yeah. One is the book, and a lot of it focuses on Molly's family and the rest of it. But then when you get to your part or at the end, it's clear that there's a whole, it's a much larger. Did you ever get a sense of how large that was? How many? So her family, it's maybe a couple dozen, but... but some of the statements you've made and are making is that this was a much wider.
Yeah.
So any sense of?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so, you know, this experience of researching this book really changed my view of history. You know, often I've written about injustices, criminal injustices before, or crime. You know, social justice issues, but you know, often when perpetrators, in this case, some of the perpetrators were caught, but many were not. And I always thought of history as a way to provide an accounting, that history can't provide justice, but it provides an accounting and hopefully identifies the perpetrators and the suspects. It records the voices of the victims and gives them a voice, and it identifies the perpetrators for eternity. And I tried my damnedest to do that. But as I looked into so many cases, you begin to realize that too many trails of evidence are gone. This was a power structure that was actively covering up the crimes. And so these were morticians who were covering up the crimes, reporters who didn't cover on them, politicians who covered them up, lawmen who covered them up. And so trying to identify all the perpetrators is impossible. It just is impossible. And, you know, when I speak to the Osage and when you speak to Osage scholars who really know, you know, they put the estimate in the scores. You know, one scholar says, you know, you can't walk through, basically one of the best historians of those says basically every family had at least one person who was affected. And another person said, you know, it's only when you walk through the cemeteries and you begin to see the ages of the deaths, because you gotta remember they had good medicine. They were rarely wealthy. These were not hungry people. You begin to get a sense of his breadth. But so it's really hard to put a number on it. But it really changed my view of history. I always thought of history as kind of when you're dealing with a case like this, it's kind of the horror of what you know. And by the end, and one of the things I really wanted to try to show, it's often the horror of what you don't know. And that adds a layer of nefariousness to the crimes, right? Because they've denied you even that ability to provide full account. And I think that's a deeply tragic. And I had never really was aware of that till I researched this and spoke to so many Osage who have spent years doing their own investigations to try to identify perpetrators because they've lived with those nagging doubts and haunted by them.
It, it, it felt to me like you could have spent another 5 years and maybe you get four more families or all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But that you sort of hint at what you're saying. But to me, that's one of the explosive parts of the...
Yeah.
And just one other quick one. The earlier part of the book with Molly and the rest of it before they get into it, you're very specific about what the place looked like.
Yeah.
And all of it, I mean, it's very rich in detail. Yeah. And I'm wondering how you got that.
So one of the good things from a historian standpoint is there were so many investigations. So you had private eyes doing investigations. You had the feds who carried out multiple investigations. You had state investigations. You also had multiple trials. And so almost everyone usually was questioned, often more than once or twice. So the book opens with a scene in Molly's house where everybody's coming. And I have Anna Brown carrying an alligator purse. I have her in the car where before she gets out of the car, she powders herself. Well, the chauffeur gave thing, he said, before she got out, she put powder on her face. And so you're able, because so many people were in the room and so many people were questioned, you're able to get a fair amount of detail. Now, from an historian standpoint, I wish there was even more, but because unfortunately, often, like with someone like Molly, she would testify, but I was always struck by how much the white authorities discounted her point of view. And I also should just say this about Molly, because it's one of the things that's true. This book is about a lot of evil, but it's also about a lot of goodness and quiet goodness. And Molly had an enormous amount of bravery. And I never say this explicitly, but here is this woman whose family is being one by one targeted. She's crusading for justice. She's hiring PIs. She's issuing rewards. She's putting a bullseye on her back. And she's doing that while the authorities are discounting her because she's a woman at that time and because she's Osage. And I thought that took great courage on her part. Anybody else? Final question?
Yeah, quick question. Yeah, I'm actually from Oklahoma. My mother was born in Fairfax, Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
She went
I'm heading there in a week. I'll be there.
She was born in 1926, yeah. A lot of it was firsthand information.
Yeah.
And actually, I grew up hearing these stories.
Yeah.
And the house is, 1926, I think the house blew up in 1926 or 27 or something like that.
House blew up in 1923.
23, yeah, okay. Yeah. I used to tell myself this would make a fascinating movie. So is there any interest or maybe it's too soon? Or?
Yeah. I mean, there has been interest, and I always say this, I really focus on the stuff that I control, the books, the research. And, I was really fortunate in my first book, they recently made it a movie, and my hope is they'll do this one as well. I think the hope, especially with a story like this, is it goes back to that missing picture. So many people like myself are just completely ignorant of this stuff. I was. I mean, part of my quest, when the question about what motivated me, partly was just to basically address my own damn ignorance. And my hope, you know, you can reach a lot of people with a book. Thank you all for coming. But you can reach, you know, with a movie, an enormous audience. So it's still very early, but it would be wonderful if they did. Yeah. Thank you so much.
One last.
Oh, can we get one more?
Speaking of films, have you seen Lost City of Z?
I did.
What
I loved
you,
it. Yes, I did. Yeah, James Gray is great.
Well, I saw it at the Environmental Film Festival and met David Gray, and it left out one of the favorite scenes in the book, in which you describe Percival and crew coming across what you described as the ricketiest, most uncrossable, unsafe bridge across the river. And the donkeys were no fools. They refused to do it. So what did Percival do? They blinded the donkeys. And I said, David, why didn't you include that scene in the film? It would have been great. Yeah. He said that would have added another $5 million to the budget.
I always say about that movie, they cut me out, but they couldn't find anyone handsome enough to play me.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.